You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. Today, I sat down with food director Carla Music and senior associate food editor Claire Saffitz to talk about all those foods that we grew up eating and we really, really loved. And then at some point when you become an adult, you're like, wait a minute, why don't I make that? My mom made it or my dad made it. Darn it, I'm going to learn how to make it. And you know what? Now we are. And we're testing these recipes, these classic recipes from the 70s and 80s. So let's do this thing. We are talking nostalgia foods with Claire Saffitz and Carla Music. Guys, my contention is that the most potent ingredient in any recipe is nostalgia. If you ate it growing up, you think it is the best dish ever. Like, oh my God, my mom made this amazing so-and-so. Even if it wasn't that amazing, if your mom made it, in your mind, it is. Carla, is that fair to say?
Well, my mom was a great cook, so.
Wait, are you trying to say she's better than Maxine?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that, but I would say she was a much better cook than her mother. She actually taught herself how to cook because the food wasn't so great.
Wow.
Yeah.
But didn't she grow up where? What's her background?
She grew up in New Jersey.
Jersey. Mm-hmm. Jewish, Italian?
No, she's Italian. We're 100%.
Every week I'm like, you sure you're not Jewish, Carla? So she's a self-made Italian gal from Jersey.
Correct.
And Claire, what about you? Where did your mom grow up?
She grew up in Baltimore.
Oh, Baltimore.
Jewish.
Good cook?
Very good cook.
Yeah.
Cooked every dinner I had growing up. We all sat together at the dinner table every night, 6:30.
In my household, Maxine Rappaport, née Barzak from West Allis, Wisconsin, was a heck of a cook also. And of course, we're not mentioning our fathers because I know my dad didn't cook. Did your guys?
My dad did cook, and he had his specialty dishes.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like every night. A lot of times he would just cook things that he wanted to eat that my mom didn't want to make or eat. So
yeah, Frank Lally was into he called it garbage pasta. If my mom was out of town, he would take all the leftovers out. And he thought that if you just added cream at the end, it didn't really matter. It would be good.
That's pretty good advice,
but
actually.
He's turned into a good cook. He's real proud of his eggs these days.
All right, so what we're going to do on today's episode is we're going to kind of do a little roundtable here where we're going to talk about dishes we grew up with and then the present day incarnations of them and how we can make them maybe even better than our mom did. I walked into the test kitchen the other day and I saw in the corner of my eye this crazy like casserole dish with these, it looked like some like Frank Gehry sculpture with these weird vertical golden brown things waving. And I was like, what the heck is that? And I learned it was tuna casserole. And those were like potato chips on end and flecked with herbs. And it was gorgeous. And I was like, that is not the tuna casserole I remember my dad making growing up. He made one dish and it was tuna casserole. And I wouldn't even like look at the stuff. But this was gorgeous. So where did this come from and what is in this tuna casserole?
It's 2.0. It's a pretty funny story, actually, because Andy Baragani, whose parents are Persian, developed these recipes. And I didn't know when I asked him to work on casseroles that he had never in his life had one. It was just not something he ever had. So he's looking and nodding, okay, tuna casserole, wow. And he had to kind of go figure it out. And so that was his riff on it. It's really all the same ingredients in a tuna casserole. So it's got the creamy sauce, it's got mushrooms, it's got tuna, but he upgraded every ingredient.
So walk us through it. So how do you make this new tuna casserole?
So you start by sauteing leeks and some mushrooms. I'm looking at Claire because we both were just talking about this. And you make a velouté out of that. So there's a little bit of flour, chicken stock, and it's like a bechamel, but it's made with stock. And then he added a little bit of cream, which gives it nice richness. I think a lot of times it could just be with milk and cheese. He ended up doing the stock, the cream, and cheddar. And then the key thing also was he used the egg noodles, the curly egg noodles, which are typical.
Mm, yes.
The Mullers, I think, is what we get up here, the Pennsylvania Dutch.
Unimpeachable, I would say.
They really are perfect, but you really have to undercook them.
I mean, because they bake further when they're in the casserole.
Yeah, it's like mac and cheese, same thing. Once it's in with that kind of liquidy sauce, which you need a lot of liquid so that it's creamy after baking, the noodles often just soak up too much and then they're mushy. And I think that's one of the key like things that people really don't like about tuna casseroles is just all one texture.
Mushiness. And then what do you do?
And then you add your tuna, which Andy used oil-packed tuna rather than just a water-packed. So the nice oil-packed Italian tuna, which just has more texture. It's not going to flake into those tiny little bits. So it's all the same ingredients. It's just the
a little bit better.
It's just the nicest version. So you have great texture in the finished thing.
So like the oil pack, those are some of those like imported Italian cans, but it's still canned tuna.
Yeah, you'll find it exactly where the anchovies and the capers are. It's usually, if it's not in your tuna aisle, then that's where it's going to be.
So you mix it all together with the noodles and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And a kind of parboiled noodles, not cooked all the way through. Mix it all together, pour it in a casserole. And then I thought this was really cool. You sort of insert the potato chips standing upright, correct?
Right, exactly. So we kept referring to it as a potato chip graveyard, kind of.
Like tombstones.
They're like tombstones. So you pour it into the casserole, you upend all your potato chips, and that is another key thing that often there people do use potato chips or breadcrumbs to give that crunchy layer, and you need that. But that was his nice take on that. Instead of crushing them up into crumbs, he left them whole, so you get like nice big bites of them.
As they always say, you eat with your eyes first. And then you also had some, was it minced dill on top?
It was
dill. And so you had the green, you had the golden brown potato chips, you had the golden yumminess of the casserole. So, but then how does it compare to the tuna casserole of the 70s with the can of mushroom soup, Campbell's mushroom soup, and the bumblebee tuna and stuff? Was it that much better in your mind?
See, I didn't grow up on this either. Is that what your dad would use? Did he use cream of mushroom?
Oh, yeah.
For someone who never had it and is into the idea of it, like, I didn't grow up eating that, but that's something at a certain point I was like, I should probably make my children tuna casserole because that's the thing that you eat. This is the best possible, most delicious version. Like, it hits all the same notes, but it's just really good.
Well, it actually, it looks gorgeous, smells gorgeous. I, of course, still did not eat it because I just, like, I can't. It haunts me. Although, you brought an interesting point up, which I thought was good casserole advice about the amount of liquid you need in a casserole. We also have a recipe for BA's best macaroni and cheese up on the website, which I make all the time now. And you start off grating some garlic and onions and sauteing that. Then you mix it. You make a bechamel sort of sauce, et cetera, with the cheese and whatnot and the milk. It's an astounding amount of liquid that you then mix in with the par-cooked pasta. And you're like, there's no way this is going to work. This is way too wet. But after it cooks for 40 minutes or so, and then it cools a little bit, you actually want it much more liquidy than you think.
It tightens up a lot. I mean, the cheese will tighten up, and so will that flour-based sauce.
Yeah, and the
noodles
the
absorb
pasta
a ton.
Yeah, so it's like always, when you're making mac and cheese or another casserole, it's always more liquid than you think. And also the other good advice I felt you always read but you never sort of heed is let it sit on the counter before you dig in. Like you don't want it piping hot because then that oozes out everywhere. You want it to sort of like come back into itself a little bit. All right, so that's tuna casserole. Claire, number two, you mentioned something about Duchess potatoes.
Yes.
Which sounds very fancy.
It is very fancy. Growing up, this was like a special occasion thing. We would get to request special birthday dinners, and this was something we all asked for. We wanted our mom to make. It was sort of a wintertime thing. She calls them Duchess potatoes. They are commonly known as twice-baked potatoes.
Wait. Twice-baked potatoes makes it sound like I'm going to,
go to the bar.
Yeah. So explain. How do you make your Duchess potatoes?
Right. These are, you start with russet potatoes. You want a fluffy, starchy potato, so nothing waxy like a Yukon Gold. So a classic russet potato. They get baked, poke a couple holes in them. My mom would put them directly on the rack in a hot oven. And then the skins kind of dry out as the inside steams. They get really fluffy. And then every time she would make them, she would try to cut them when they were way too hot and kind of like burn her hands a little bit.
It's astounding the amount of steam that escapes from a baked potato.
Yes.
Yeah. You're like,
yes. And she would always make a lot. I mean, I grew up in a family with five people, but she would make like nine potatoes because we all ate way more than I think the average family ate.
So you could just fight over the
I would
one.
Just, I would, why not just make 10? So you
get
two.
Right.
She's like, I'll only have one. That's a classic mom move.
Or we'd have,
no, it's okay. It's okay.
Or we'd have one left over, but like it wouldn't make it in the fridge because we would eat it as we were clearing the table,
exactly.
Which is a common thing.
You bake the potato, you split them in half lengthwise, all the way through.
Yes.
And then you scoop out the, what do you do?
Separate the halves and you scoop out the insides with a large spoon. And you don't want to, you want to be kind of gentle so you don't tear the skins too much because all of that potato is going to go back into the skin the second time around. But first you basically make like a whipped or mashed potato mixture. So she would always add butter and milk. Mm. When I make them now, I like to do a version with sour cream or some chives or something.
And mixed in.
Mixed in with the potato. So
what about cheese? Do you do cheese at all or no?
not cheese, but sometimes a little bit on top, but not in with the potato mixture. But she would also roast garlic in the oven.
Ooh.
Roasted garlic felt very big in the 90s.
Very big.
She would just throw some in a little Pyrex bowl covered with some olive oil and foil on top and roast that in the oven for about an hour. Yep. Wow.
And then you would mix that in with as you're whipping the potatoes?
Yes. And my mom liked to use a hand mixer, which violates every rule of mashed potato making.
But when you make gnocchi, you can do it in a stand mixer.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you can't.
Yes, you can.
No, you cannot.
Go over to Montrachet with Remy Lavand in 1999. We were making gnocchi with stand mixer.
Yeah, well, my mom was definitely channeling
Montrachet
that.
Is still open? No.
No, but Remy's still working.
Yeah. Mm. Anyway, all right, so she's got the stand mixer. She's whipping the potatoes.
Hand mixer.
She would
just go with the two beaters. Yeah. Also, my mom's name is Saucy, which I wanted to share.
Literally?
Her real name is Sharon, but her whole life, everyone's called her Saucy. So,
was she a fan of History of the World, Part 1? No?
No idea.
Don't get saucy with me, Ben. That line, Mel Brooks? Anyways,
I'll share that with her.
This would be a separate podcast. Anyways, okay, so you'd whip them together.
Yes.
You now said you might throw in chives or something else.
Sour cream, chives, something to kind of enrich the potatoes, give it something savory. So it could be chives or caramelized onions or roasted garlic, as she would do.
I like that. And now, would she use like a fancy pastry bag to pipe them back in, or should she just spoon them back in?
Saucy was not down with a pastry bag. Dinner had to get on the table.
Yeah.
So you just use a big spoon and then kind of like do big heaping mounds of the potato back into the skin. So you always have like a skin or two left over because you wanted to put more potato back into back into the skins than came out. So that would be something I would probably eat.
Right.
Would you, you could bake the skins also, they get crispy. Would you now, does Claire Saffitz, do you use a pastry bag to look all like French Culinary Institute or something?
I have been known to do that. And real Duchess potatoes, the classic French dish, Duchess potatoes uses, you have to use like the star tip, make the little mounds of potato.
So what typically, if it was your birthday and you were having the Duchess potatoes, what would the main course be that they would be accompanying?
Probably steak. We definitely did steak and potatoes a lot growing up. It was also the 90s when carbs were good.
I feel like you grew up on the set of Anchorman or something.
It was the Midwest. It was the 90s. Pasta was good. We loved it.
Life was good. It was very good. Some Courvoisier for cocktails afterwards. No? No. Sorry. I'll just stop. All right. Carla, moving on. So, all right. So Dutch potatoes. Thank you. And wait, there's a recipe online, correct? Kind of? Sort of?
We have... Well, on our site, we have a twice-baked potatoes. I'll just add as a final note, what made them Duchess potatoes is they got a sprinkling of paprika on top before they went back into the oven and crisp. So that was the signature.
All right. If that's not enough carbs, Carla, what do you got coming up next? What's your nostalgia favorite?
So one thing that I think I ate for lunch most weekends and now I cook on regular rotation for my own son is a classic grilled cheese. No messing around, no sourdough bread, no upgrading the thing. It's Pullman bread, it's mayonnaise, and Adam and I disagree
about
this.
First of all, right, we want this because I think the average person, explain the mayonnaise thing first of all.
So the mayonnaise is a magical, I think most people put butter on the outside of a grilled cheese sandwich, which is a totally acceptable thing to do and completely fine. But mayonnaise is it's really a food stylist trick. It has oils in it. It has a little bit of egg yolk. And so it has a really great caramelization kind of property to it.
So you will spread it on the outside of each side of the
bread. I put it on the inside too because it's just a little bit of flavor.
Why not?
Yeah. But the way that it browns in the pan is pretty magical.
Okay. But now my question is this. So you spread it on the top of one side of the bread. You flip that over, put it in the pan. But are you putting it in a dry pan or is there a little butter already in that pan also?
A little bit of butter is good.
But not a lot. You don't need a lot.
You don't need a lot because it's really going to self-butter.
I like a good wheat bread, but I hear you on the good classic white Pullman. Let's talk cheese because that's also an important thing. What's your cheese policy?
It depends who I'm making the grilled cheese for.
Okay,
it's for me, I love cheddar.
Okay. And do you slices or do you grate it? Because I've heard people grate it. I've never
grating
done that before.
Grating is great.
It's because it melts more evenly?
It does. And it melts more quickly. So sometimes you'll have the perfectly brown outside of the bread, but the cheese in the middle, you can tell it's just not there yet.
All right. And if you're making it for one of your boys?
It's Munster.
Munster?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. Cosmo Music is a Munster lover.
Interesting. We have
very melty and it's mild.
In the magazine, we have espoused the virtues of American cheese, which I love on a burger. I do not love it on a grilled cheese just because I think American plays well when it's on something else. When it's just on its own, it's a little too American cheesy, in my opinion.
Totally.
Totally.
I think cheddar is great. I think Gruyere is great. It depends what you're into. You could blend, you know, two cheeses. I've made them with mozzarella. I mean,
yeah.
All right, you know, if it melts, it's good to go.
You're making me hungry. And then obviously, that's another thing you grew up with, the grilled cheese. But then you'd have the Campbell's cream of tomato soup on the side. And
I
the
loved
dip.
That.
The dip was, that's just still one of the best things ever.
I think the thing about nostalgic foods is that it's the way you grew up eating it.
Yes.
You know, so you and I, we grew up with different fabulous mothers. And we feel we've...
But we both grew up eating grilled cheese and tomato soup.
And so will our children.
All right. So one thing I grew up eating, I grew up not eating tuna casserole, but I did grow up eating once a week, guaranteed. It was meatloaf and mashed potatoes night. And my mom would make a meatloaf, three strips of bacon, which we'd all fight for, big bowl of mashed potatoes. And then like we always had to, quote unquote, eat our salad, which was always iceberg lettuce, underripe tomatoes and a few cucumbers and some like Thousand Island dressing. I grew up in the 70s. And like, whatever, you just kind of ate the salad. But the meatloaf and mashed potatoes were stupendous. And the weird thing is, like, I make a lot of my mom's recipes now. I make her sweet and spicy brisket on the Jewish holidays, which is phenomenal. I make her latkes. I do a lot of things that I love. Weirdly, I have never made meatloaf, like, in my life. And I cook a lot of meat. I make a lot of steaks, like burgers, all that stuff. And I still don't know, help me out here, because I don't know how do you get the really, because it's not a burger, you know? And there's something moist and flavorful, and a meatloaf is a different creature, and I know you're supposed to put breadcrumbs in and eggs in and all that sort of stuff, and it's not meatballs, and like, what is the deal with meatloaf, and how do you do a good one besides putting bacon on top?
It's a really tough question. Actually, it was really hard for us to develop this recipe in the test kitchen.
And this recipe being?
BA's best meatloaf.
Yes.
I think it's BA's best beef meatloaf.
And it looks gorgeous. Yeah. Go online and look at this picture. It's like you guys braided the bacon on top, which is like the best styling move I've ever seen. I'm like, oh my God. It's like with the glazed ketchup and the braided bacon. And like you just see that and you're like, I'm making that.
Pretty classy.
But I haven't made it. So what the heck? What's the deal?
So we really went around and around with this because everybody had very specific memories of what the meatloaf should be. And again, that very specific memory was their mother's meatloaf. It was like, that's the meatloaf. You don't eat meatloaf like out, you know? It was the one that you grew up on. So we debated mixing beef, pork, and veal, just beef and pork. We tried it both ways. We decided very early on that it needed to have bacon, but even whether or not you bake it in a loaf pan or you freeform it on a sheet pan.
See, that's an important thing. Yeah. Like do you want, because the loaf pan keeps it moister, but the freeform gets you more crispy on the outside. So.
And that is exactly why we ended up doing it freeform, because the loaf pan on the sides, you just kind of get that steamy texture.
Yeah,
it's not that pleasant. It's all, you know, you need to have the bacon for sure. And we really did actually in the end treat it like a meatball.
Did you use like bread soaked in milk, or you use breadcrumbs, or what do you bind the meat with?
We did all of those things, and in the end, I actually pulled on a trick that I learned from Rocco Dispirito's mom when they had Rocco's Italian American. She made all those meatballs.
And
she was like famous.
Full disclosure: you worked with Rocco.
No, I did. I worked with her, and this is how I learned how to make these meatballs, and they were really, really good. But she had a trick of putting stock instead of milk, because meatballs are similar. Yeah. People do the squozing out. Bread and the milk and the eggs and the thing.
I don't think squozing is a word.
Listen.
Rocco's mom says it's a word. It's a word.
You knew what I meant.
Yes.
All right.
All right. So
her trick was she would add chicken stock to the meat mixture.
The meat, but then where are the breadcrumbs?
The breadcrumbs were in there as well. But instead of using milk or another kind of liquid, it was chicken stock instead of milk.
Interesting.
And it's really good.
And then there's eggs also?
There's eggs also.
What do eggs do? Why do you have to add eggs?
They bind it? Yeah.
Yeah, they help keep it. When you slice it, you don't want the meatloaf to crumble. You want to have like a nice, discreet slice so that the next day you can make a meatloaf sandwich.
See, there's interesting. And then you also have some onion and garlic flavoring in there. So it's interesting. Like you had mentioned like a little bit looser crumb, which is kind of what I grew up eating. But then I was last year visiting my wife's grandmother in Western Pennsylvania, Yankee. I don't know if she knew saucy or not. but her meatloaf was more of that almost creamy texture. Like it seemed like there was a lot of like the white bread soaked in milk and mushed together. And so it was almost like a force meat, if you want to get all French about it.
Right.
But it sort of, and it was, a very different sort of thing. I thought it was delicious. But yeah, it didn't have that crummy sort of texture, crumbly texture. You know what I also love when I was growing up, the meatloaf, because it was baked in a like in a pan as opposed to a loaf pan, around the edges, all the fat would sort of pull up. But there's also that weird sort of milky sort of like fat sort of stuff. And then it would then get kind of caramelized and like sort of you would reach in there and then throw that in your mashed potatoes. And
it's really good.
Ooh.
And you talked about the glaze, too. So the bacon, we also went through kind of, should we make our own little ketchup sweet and sour glaze? And we tried that. And it turns out, no, you should not. You should just use ketchup. But we doctored it up with some cider vinegar, some brown sugar. So
just taking a little
more tang. Yeah, just taking the flavors of ketchup and just bumping it up a little bit. And that makes that really pretty glaze that also gets a little sticky.
Yeah.
It's really good.
On the topic of comfort food, it has to be Heinz ketchup.
Yes.
I think that bears repeating.
On a
burger, on the meatloaf, on anything. I do not want fancy ketchup.
No.
I do not abide by it.
Is it good? Tell me one time that homemade ketchup was like better than the Heinz.
Never.
I just don't believe in it at all.
All right, Claire. So round two. You got a little pasta dish you want to talk about.
Yeah.
Right?
This is probably my earliest food memory, is eating linguine with clam sauce that my dad would make. And this was one of Jeff's specialties that he would make. He would tell my mom to leave the kitchen. This was his. He sort of liked to play chef a little bit. He would make like shrimp etouffee and my mom would just leave. Like, goodbye.
Whatever.
Saucy out. But this was really his specialty, and it's something I remember eating as a really young kid, maybe 5 years old. My parents had a policy that like they didn't make two dinners. So they said, like, this is what we want to eat, so you guys are going to eat it, too.
That's a good policy.
Wow. So how did Jeff do it, and how do you do it?
Well, growing up in St. Louis, it was canned clams and clam juice from a jar, which never seemed like, why would you do it any other way? It was like, pretty easy. And it was delicious, I have to say. Like, I mean, of course, maybe that's my memory of it now. And we would never make it that way now. We would go out and get fresh clams and open them up at home. But he would basically start in a skillet, lots of olive oil, lots and lots of garlic, even some red pepper flakes, fewer if it was for kids.
I like that.
They'd throw in a bunch. Then the clams go in, a little bit of, I think right before the clams, he would hit it with a little white wine, reduce that down. The clams would go in, some of the clam juice, reduce that. And then you have in a pot next to that skillet, the pasta is boiling, cook it al dente, transfer it into the skillet. Don't drain it too well because you want some of that pasta water to go into the skillet too. Always got hit with a little bit of parsley, but like the curly kind that would like scratch the top of your throat as you swallowed the food. It was always curly parsley.
I love how everyone of our generation, and you're younger than, well, you're all younger than me, but Carl and I are at least in the ballpark.
Yeah.
But it's just like nowadays, like, the notion of using anything but flat leaf parsley is totally anathema. You're like, curly parsley?
You can't even find it. You don't even see it in stores anymore.
I feel bad for it. all right. So then how often do you make it these days?
I make it very often.
All right. So what's Claire's technique?
So always starting with fresh clams. That's the important thing. And I like a very high clam to pasta ratio. Every bite should have clams in it. So different types of clams have different flavors. I like the big quahog clams because there's a lot of meat in them.
Do you chop them up?
I chop them up. And
this
then I'll add some little neck clams, the smaller guys, in addition to the quahogs. Because it's like if all the clams only come from the clams that are in the shell in the bowl, it's not enough. So I really like a deep clam flavor.
So you'll make the quahogs, take them out of the shell, chop them up. And you'll have a mixture of chopped clams as well as whole clams in the finished dish.
Absolutely.
Fascinating.
Interesting. That's very 2.0.
Other than that, though, it's really the same. I don't think it's a dish that should be too complicated.
Yeah.
You know, I think everything should come together in a skillet. I've seen people make versions where they open up the raw clams first because they don't want to cook, you know, because they want that fresher clam flavor. It seems like a lot of work. I do think it's one of those dishes where you want dried pasta.
Yes.
It's not a fresh pasta thing. Don't try to make it fancier than it is. You want a dried pasta that's going to really absorb all of that flavor. And Adam, I have a question, and I think I know the answer, but how do you feel about adding cheese?
I mean, I'm not one of those guys like, oh, you can't have cheese with seafood, because whatever, you do what you want. But that never occurred to me.
Really? Because growing up, I would like pile on the grated Parmesan cheese. And
out of the green can?
It wasn't out of the green can, but it was a pre-grated. We stopped just short of the Kraft stuff, which I always loved as a kid when I got to have it.
Can I say this? So actually, it's interesting. Speaking of the can of Parm, the other day I was making my son like some sort of pasta, like basically cacio pepe, butter and pasta, all that sort of stuff. And we had a container of the what do you call the grated Parm that's super fine, you know, not like shreds, but what kind of grated do you call that?
Like kind of finely grated, I guess.
Yeah, but
not microplaned. You're talking
about like powder. It's like a, you know, but mm-hmm. it's fresh Parmesan. I think we bought it someplace like Italy or whatever. So it was nice.
Yeah.
But I was like tossing the pasta in the pan with the butter and this and that. And I was like, oh my God, this absorbs so much better and sort of becomes creamy and saucy. Whereas sometimes the bigger shredded stuff you do with the big microplane can get stuck to the bottom
really
of the
dissolve.
Can. Doesn't really dissolve or gets clumpy. I was like, this is genius. I love having a nice hunk of Parmesan in the fridge, but the finely grated stuff
is nice.
Is great for
tossing.
No,
we were talking about this recently. I can't remember what recipe it was about, but we had a whole
chicken parm.
Was it the chicken parm? That's right. And you can get that texture if you use your food processor. So take a hunk.
Yeah, just the regular blade and just throw
it
and just really hit it.
Yep.
It's interesting. Like I think
because it makes it round instead of flat shreds.
Yeah.
They are like beaded.
Carl, we got time for one more, and I'm hoping it's a dessert because I'm really hungry and I've had all sorts of salty, carby goodness right now, but I need some sugar.
Chocolate mousse.
Yes.
I grew up on it. I loved it. This was like a fancy. I remember having this as a kid at like a fancy dinner. My parents would take us to restaurants. I feel like I grew up underneath a restaurant table, and chocolate mousse if it was on the menu, I was ordering it. And my mom would also make it at home.
In terms of, like, you got your chocolate, but then are you using egg whites? Are you using cream? Or
So the recipe that I really love is on Bon Appetit as well, and it's just called dark chocolate mousse. And in this recipe, you melt the chocolate, and then you have
And what kind of chocolate? Like what percent?
A bittersweet. Mm-hmm. I mean, but I really do believe you can use what you like. Yeah. You know, I like a nice, rich chocolate, and when you add the sugar and the eggs, it mellows it out. So I think you can go with something like 72%. So you melt your chocolate, and then you have egg whites in one area, and you've got egg yolks in the other. You whip the egg yolks with sugar until it's ribbon consistency. I was going to ask you what that mixture is technically. Like just egg yolk whipped with sugar until it's light. And
I think the technical term is you're blanching the eggs and sugar together.
Cool. So you do that. You're like dissolving the sugar. Yeah. You're making the egg fluffy, but it's also creamy because it's just the yolks.
Yep.
And then that gets folded into the melted chocolate. Yep. And then you have to clean your beaters, but then you beat your egg whites until they're shiny. They're holding stiff peaks, but they haven't dried out and started to look that curdly. Stuff and then you fold that in until just there could be a couple of streaks remaining, but that's where that lightness comes from. So you have the richness from the yolks and the sugar, and the chocolate obviously is like velvety and delicious, and the egg white will give it lift. And when you spoon into it, you hear those little bubbles kind
and
of
you
popping,
see the bubbles
and you see the bubbles and so then you chill it. The recipe online makes 8, which is perfect for a family of 4 because then you have 4 more for the next day. And then they get finished with whipped cream.
That's the one I used to make one when I was at GQ. I wrote about on the Nestle chocolate bar in Paris. A friend who had lived there, and you get the French chocolate, which is probably like I want to say in the 60% of sweet, bittersweet. But yeah, and it's remarkable. It's just chocolate, sugar, eggs, and that's it. But by separating the eggs, you create that amazing sort of like chemistry of the fluffiness on one and the richness of the yolks and how it's all blended together. And the sort of the mousse is infused with the fluffy airiness of the whites. And you get that. It almost gets almost like chewy. And
it's funny because it's great when you first make it. If you lick the beaters, like it's delicious. But when it sets up, the texture changes so much, and it's just that has that completely different texture, and you know it dissolves slowly. It's great.
Oh my God! Wow. All right, I'm hungry. I think we had like the makings of like 3 amazing dinner parties right here.
Totally.
Well, that was a lot of fun, guys. I'm hungry. I hope you are too. And for you listeners, you can find the recipes on bonappetit.com. Check them out, and thanks for listening, Carla Music, Claire Saffitz.
See you soon.
Thanks, Adam.
This podcast has been brought to you by Belle Cushing and Carrie Polis, with editing by Mitra Kaboli and additional help from Christina Che and Lily Sherman. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Greedies. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us anything about this or any episode, please email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com.